Awesome. Yeah, Ben, thanks for chatting on the podcast. I appreciate it.
No problem. Always lovely to chat.
So yeah, you're from Cactus Outdoor. I wear this most days in winter.
Nice.
So it's mostly actually stuck in my backpack that I don't forget a beanie. And I've got some of your other clothes, and I really like outdoor gear that lasts. I mean, that's so much gear. It's just built for a season or built for 1 or 2 years, and then they're gone. And I really wear things that I buy. So it's awesome to talk to you just because your gear, you know, your gear lasts. Yeah. So who are you? What do you do at Cactus Outdoors?
Yeah, so I'm the majority shareholder. I'm on the board. I'm sort of involved day to day. I've been around since the start, pretty much. And yeah, as you kind of alluded to, you know, our jam is making gear that lasts a very, very long time. We've got people that are wearing pants that they've owned for 20 years. We've had lots and lots of people get married in our gear, get buried in our gear. We don't do seasonal. We don't do stuff that wears out. Our thing is just tools that people can rely on to help them get the job done.
Cactus kind of started almost like a Patagonia story, like climbing bums, right? Like, how did it start?
Yeah, so Quillam, who originally started it, he was a climber. He was the youngest person to do the Grand Traverse of Cook. He was a climbing bum. He wasn't particularly big on school and all that sort of stuff. And like so many other outdoor brands out there, his mum was a textile artist, and so she taught him to sew. He started sewing in his bedroom, making chalk bags, selling to his buddies, and it was a way to pay for climbing trips and not have to get a real job. And so that's the way it started. And then, you know, a few years later, Rob, who also a climber and was a postie, got involved because he knew there was an issue with New Zealand Post. Posties getting bad backs and stuff, and so he designed a new system for New Zealand Post posties, and I got involved. I was a bit of a climber, like a tramper, mountain biker, and so those three, Willem, Rob, and I, we're still involved. We still own it. I'm proud about lots of things in our organisation, but the fact that after 32 years, the three of us are still talking and still in business together, despite, you know, different levels of involvement, is pretty cool, really.
What was designed for the post?
Yeah, so back in the day, and we're going back now, literally 30 years, Posties had just a super simple shoulder bag, kind of like you see newspaper delivery people wearing nowadays. And back then there was a lot of post going out, and posties were getting bad backs and stuff like that. And so Rob had a outdoor background, a climbing background, and he kind of came up with the idea that if you had a system that mimicked the, you know, shoulder straps, waist belt, sternum strap of a climbing pack, tramping pack, but had mailbags hang off it, then instead of, you know, posties taking the weight on one shoulder and off to the side, they could take the weight on the hips. And so he designed that. We made those for New Zealand Post for 10-15 years, and there's still posties walking around wearing those bags.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's cool that you're basically solving problems, really, aren't you?
Yeah, so I think, we talk a lot about the stuff we do, our tools to help people get their jobs done. So we're not about fashion. We're not about making someone look better. We're about making someone work better and perform what they need to do, whether that is in, you know, a climbing situation, a biking situation, or whatever.
And then you, I mean, you describe yourself as a bit of a, you know, tramper, hiker. Did you make a career out of that just through Cactus Outdoor, or was there other aspects to your career also? Was Cactus your full-time gig?
So I dropped out of school and I actually did an apprenticeship. So I'm an electrician by trade. Yeah. And the reason why I'm filthy today is because I'm actually doing some renovations downstairs in the factory. But So I did my apprenticeship. I finished my apprenticeship, and then I did some time overseas and got involved in Cactus. So Cactus, you know, I did have a trade before that. Cactus has been my sort of on and off vocation for about 30 years, but I do other stuff on the side. I'm on a lot of boards and, you know, do a lot of governance and consulting and other things as well.
And am I right? It's a bit of a family affair. Did I interview, I think, your son for a article when I was still working at Stuff?
Yeah. So I'm really aware that this is going to come across kind of the wrong way. It'll come across as nepotism. But the thing that I'm proud of, other than the fact that you know, Colin, Rob and I are still working together, is that my two boys, you know, 22 and 24, work in the business. You know, I saw Yoni write an email, my oldest son, to someone recently and talk about that. I used to call around the factory floor when I was a toddler. So those guys have only ever known Cactus existing and me being involved. And so they are as passionate, if not more, as I am, which is awesome.
And are they heavy outdoorsmen?
Yes, yeah, so my oldest son is a runner, so he's done a bunch of ultra marathons. He's the youngest ever Australasian, to do a 100-mile running race. So he's into that. Younger son is into hunting and the outdoors. So they're both grown up. My wife's when she was at university, was a huge tramper, so they grew up from babies spending time in the outdoors.
Tell me about your design principles. I mean, just not planning for, you know, having something go obsolete, and it's in a way it's bad business, right? Because good business in inverted commas is getting that product to be replaced every year or something. Like, how do you, in this world where there's so many things that can take away from your profit, like, tell me about that philosophy.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It's, if you're just looking at the financial return, it's a terrible business model. We sell to a small market because we're quite niche, because we're specialist products. We make stuff that takes a long, long, long time to wear out, if ever, and we don't do seasonal releases in fashion. So the business model is terrible from a purely kind of maximizing financial return perspective. If you look at our impact on the environment, the fact that people wear a pair of pants, for 20 years, then there's some really positive environmental things that come from that. And we're on a bit of a mission socially and environmentally to change the way business is done. So yeah, that's totally our jam. Our jam is that we believe the best way to minimize your environmental impact and your social impact of your consumption is to buy a limited number of things and to buy things that last a very long time. And so our design principle is very much that. We're not about lots of techie features that no one uses. So back in the day, it was super popular to do adjustable tramping packs. So you had these really complex, heavy and fragile adjustable pack systems so that one pack size couldn't fit everyone. And that was great for the manufacturers because they only had to make one pack and it could fit everyone with different back lengths. And we've never done that. Our thing is that we do three sizes of pack, because you buy a tramping pack twice or three times in your life. You should buy one that is fitted, you know, is the right size for you, that doesn't have all these other features that you're only going to use once and then break. So that's kind of our design principle.
How are your products tested? Is it kind of in-house, everybody just on their own outdoor missions, like testing, or like, how does that system work? Like, maybe talk me through a product that's been on your shelves for a couple of years, but maybe changed, and then maybe a new product also, just kind of the two different approaches.
Yeah, so the change thing we do very infrequently. So we generally, changes will more be a case of, hey, we've seen this product out in the market for 5 or 10 years and we've had a few repairs come back, and this is a particular area that you know is failing. And so we'll maybe do a tweak there. In terms of new products, so you know, I spent a month or so in Nepal last summer, their winter, climbing and trekking with my family. And so we all had prototype stuff on, packs and down jackets and insulated stuff and rainwear and whatever. So we test out in the field. And I think that this comes back to us about not even our design philosophy, our business philosophy. Despite the fact that we sell, you know, thousands of products and we have customers all around the world, we still have the same ethos that we're simply making products that we want to use and our friends want to use. And so we think of our customers as part of our tribe. We think of them as our you know, testing crew and development crew. But, you know, it's really right, because every brand talks about their community and their tribe. And so if I say it, I sound like just another person jumping on that bandwagon. And so it is genuinely what we feel. And I guess I would put it down to my you know, assessment is that the feedback we get from our folks in terms of their sense of ownership of the brand kind of confirms that is the way people see us, I guess.
Yeah, I did a bit of Landsort training. I'm not involved with them anymore. I kind of started out and decided to pull out. But some of the kind of the Alpine rescue guys there, or who do Alpine stuff off the, you know, on their free time, are all wearing Cactus gear. And you can see some of those pants have like been through the ringer, but they're like, there's nothing wrong with them. You know, they're just like. And that brings me to another thing, repair versus replace. You know, if I buy, I mean, I've got a Mac backdrop on. If it really is damaged, I can take it to a local seamstress maybe and have it fixed. But you do that stuff in-house. I can send a product back to you. Was that from the get-go, or was it something that came in later? Like,
I mean, because we've always been makers, and so we've always had, you know, our own factories. We've got you know, a pretty large factory, you know, downstairs where I'm sitting now in Litchfield Street in Christchurch with a heap of sewing machinists. And yeah, we do repairs. I will say that they do, you know, the smell of some of the repairs that get sent back is interesting. So plea out there, not for me, but for our employees, for people to maybe have a think about washing some of their gear before they send it back.
Yeah, I saw that on your website also, like you asked to please clean it.
Yeah, totally. So we know that's, I mean, and the thing is that, I don't know, maybe I'm different, but for me, when I go out on the tram or when I go out, you know, when I'm out working at home, swinging the chainsaw or whatever, you know, I remember every little scrape and nick in my pants. I remember the, you know, when I fell over and you know, landed onto a barbed wire and tore something. And so, you know, we think of the sort of scrapes and nicks not as sort of failure points, but as kind of badges of honor that shows that we've been using our gear the way it was meant to be.
Yeah. Just before I forget, what did you and your family go and do in Nepal?
So we took the boys when they were only little. Well, not that little, I guess maybe 10, 12 or something, and did Everest Base Camp and Kokiri and the Chola Pass, and we always told them that we'd go back once they'd finished school. And so we went and took them, and actually took their partners as well, and we did three passes, so Rinjola, Kongmala and Chola, and my older son and I also went and climbed Lobache, which was pretty cool. I mean, it was actually very cool in terms of temperature, because it was the middle of winter and howling wind and minus 25 or something. You know, it's such an incredible place. You know, there's no internet. At that time of the year, there's no one there. You get up in the morning, you know, you decide from the two or three options what you're actually going to eat that day, and you just get out and walk. And it's, again, I'll sound like, you know, crazy hippie or something, but just the simplicity and peacefulness and calm that comes from no choices, no media, just big sky, big mountains, and ever smiling people is awesome.
And then big missions in New Zealand that you've done recently. What have you done recently?
Yeah, so I used to do a bit of tramping back in the day. My jam now is running. So I run ultras, and so I've done the Old Ghost. I'm one of only five people left that have done all of the seven or eight, I think, Old Ghost Ultra races since 2016. But yeah, I've done a bunch of things, quite a few 100-mile races and 100k races and stuff all around the place.
I'm jumping around considerably, but you locally produce most of your gear, which is actually once again almost a bad business model, but it's great and makes me want to support you, because a lot of places just really exploit workers in other countries. You've got about 100 seamstresses, or how do you call it, working for you?
Yeah, machinists. Yeah, we're now the largest domestic manufacturer of clothing, which, wow. Believe me, is it really sad that that's all it takes to be the largest, because only 30, 40 years ago, Lane Crichton had thousands and thousands. But we do import some stuff, and completely open and honest about that, because for a number of different reasons, that's the reality for us. But we are super, super proud that we still have machinists here and that we keep them employed, and people are super proud of the work that they do. And they love to see people come in who do amazing, crazy missions wearing gear that they've sewn.
What's the kind of pathway for someone to be a machinist? Is it anyone? Is it someone that maybe studied fashion but just really want to sit and kind of make things? Like who's that person on the floor?
Yeah, so you're going to get me up on my soapbox now about the perils of our globalization economic model. But
please go as in-depth as you want to. This is what I want to hear.
Yeah, so until very recently, our demographic was split pretty evenly between two demographics. One is quite elderly. Elderly is a relative term, but getting older women who had been in this industry 30, 40 sometimes 50 years. And then the second demographic is younger, also women, because it does tend to be generally women who sit on sewing machines, fortunately. Refugee immigrant women from Eastern, generally from Asian Eastern countries. Interestingly, we've tried really hard. So Ara used to be the Crusher. Polytechnic runs a great fashion school, and we've tried really hard to encourage graduates from Ara to get on, to start their work in the industry. And what I've noticed is that generally, historically, graduate fashion school graduates want to be Karen Walker, and they sure as hell don't want to go anywhere near an apparel factory. Mm. But I've noticed that changing. So our designer is a graduate of design school. We have maybe three or four people who are graduates, started as sewing machinists and now working in different areas of the business, the tech team do patterning or supply chain or whatever. And we've got some graduates who are machinists. So it's really good to see that happen, because it is, to an extent, a dying trade. And I think much more fundamentally, we have to think about the sort of the hollowing out of the manufacturing sector in New Zealand, not just apparel, but just generally. No one does anything in New Zealand anymore. We're happy to import everything from overseas. And, we're always going to rely to some extent on overseas. But in terms of resilience, we need a core sort of range of skills in New Zealand still, I think.
Those graduates entering, do you think it's kind of TV shows like the Great British Sewing Bee and stuff like that that kind of made them think it's cool again? Or how did that change? Was it like you guys going to a polytechnic and saying, hey, listen, there's an opportunity? Why that changed? Well, why do you think of that change?
I mean, we do that. So we do engage with the polytechnics and the different schools. I think it's maybe it's a realization that, you're not going to be the next Karen Walker 5 minutes after coming out of design school. And fundamentally, you actually need to understand how apparel is made if you want to design apparel. Mm. So, I'm hopeful that it's a more general sort of trend. We'll see.
How's your sewing skills?
So I proudly, I often tell my boys, my buddy and I, when we finished school, we went and did a cycle tour and trip around the South Island, and we both made our own panniers, front and rear panniers for that. I still, when we're at shows, we always take a sewing machine with us so we can hem people's pants while we're at the show. And yeah, I can do that fine. I don't spend any time on a sewing machine here anymore, but I can still sew.
Yeah, that's the one skill I definitely don't have, but that I really, really wish I had. What happened with the New Zealand industry? I mean, I'm not aware of the history of it. Was it just everything shifted to China? Like, when did that happen in terms of manufacturing?
Yeah, so in the 90s, also the 80s, 90s, tariffs, reduced from, because back in the day, so if you go back to the 70s, there were import quotas, so not only was it more expensive to get stuff from overseas, but you actually couldn't bring it in. Quotas went, and then slowly tariffs went, and we're now in a situation where there's no tariffs on clothing. And so once that starts to happen, if you're I'm not going to name the different brands, but if you're brands that are looking to scale massively and compete on price, you've really only got one option. And I think that, the thing that saddens me, and like I say, we import stuff, and I totally understand that, it's not as binary as everything should be made in New Zealand, nothing should be imported. But I do, we're very open and honest about the stuff that we import. But when I see, New Zealand brands talk about their products all being made of New Zealand, when they import everything, I don't know what that even means. Just own it. It's fine. It is what it is, but just own it.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. You also do a kind of rescuer and police and NZDF gear. How did that? I mean, you've got that radio unit that I see a lot of the Landsar guys are using. Is that just you saw a need, or someone was involved with Landsar? How did that kind of come to be, that specific unit?
Yes, so there's two distinct parts of the business. And yes, that radio harness is something that we've made for 20 or so years. And that was because, especially Quillen spends a lot of time, skiing and backcountry. And we do a lot of work with ski patrollers and stuff. And ski patrollers have radios. So that was fundamentally for them. But about 5 years ago, we acquired another business. So now there's two parts of our business. There's the cactus stuff that everyone knows and loves and sees, but we have another business, and that is a contract manufacturer. And so that makes uniforms for the police, the army, the navy, the air force, fire service. And so I'm a volunteer firefighter. I've been a volunteer firefighter for 25 years, and the uniform that I wear as a volunteer firefighter was made in this factory 25 years ago. And so the guy that used to own this business is Pathway now. He always used to say that Anzac Day was the proudest day of his year, because he would go to an Anzac Day parade and literally every single service person on the parade ground was wearing a uniform that had come through his factory. And our staff, we've got a photo sitting around somewhere of King Charles, as he was then, Prince Charles, wearing a uniform that we made. And that's pretty, there's a lot of pride from our staff around that.
With the fire, I mean, this might be not the question that you can answer, I don't know, but PFAS has been in like the kind of outdoor spotlight for a while, and even the firefighting thing. Like, how does one, I mean, I don't know what you use, but how does one get something like PFAS out of the outdoor, clothes, and how do you manufacture something that keeps rain away that's not reliant on that? Because that's very topical at the moment, or has been for a couple of years, right?
Yeah, so I think, there's two parts of that. And I think it's important to be really transparent about that.
Yeah.
Some of those terrible chemicals, which are terrible for the environment, terrible for people and all that stuff, are the best way to, in this case, produce waterproof fabrics. It's being forced a lot by Europe. So Europe is banning a bunch of different things. It means that people need to understand that because the regulatory environment is forcing it, but also as people are more aware about environmental and health implications, we need to be realistic in terms of what we expect. But that's a journey, and it's you know, you see it across lots of different things. I mean, you know, denim, for example, you know, there's all those tales about, you know, cheap denim factories in Asia where the rivers run blue and all that sort of stuff. There's more awareness of that. So there's this kind of combination of sort of consumer awareness and regulation. And I don't think we should rely on regulation solving all the problems. Regulation is an aid to kind of consumers making more informed decisions.
Yeah. How do you source material? Like, how do you, I mean, you, like you mentioned, I mean, there's, you've actually got a set amount of products and you just do them really well. But you don't change materials a lot. Just how do you source materials? Do you go to a factory overseas, or does someone come here, or is there specific things that you think this is just the it, we're going to use only this? Like, how do you make those decisions?
Yeah, so if we went back 20, 30 years, there were lots of fabric agents in New Zealand, and they'd come around visiting and you can source whatever you wanted. Those days are pretty much gone. So now we source almost all of our fabrics, the vast majority of our fabrics, directly from either from mills overseas, be that Europe or Asia or wherever, or from agents, you know, overseas that deal with those mills. And for us, I mean, you're right, we have quite a, at some levels, quite a simple palette of fabrics. But that said, if you look at, you know, our finance guy would suggest we have anything but a simple palette, because our inventory is really, really high, because there are a lot of different fabrics. I mean, you've got your canvases, and then you've got your sort of Cordura type fabrics, and with each of those there's different weights, and then you've got colors, and then you've got, so it is pretty complex. Again, we tend to be pretty stable in terms of our use of fabrics, and we tend to prefer the sort of traditional, well-proven sort of fabrics that have been around for, we don't make leather packs, because, you know, leather packs, what was being made, you know, 500 years ago, we've got a bit more with the times than that, but we tend not to use a lot of super high tech fabrics that maybe aren't as proven.
Was the farming industry influenced on you? Because you've got like kind of very, not going to break, going to keep you warm, going to keep you dry, but not necessarily lighter kind of hiking stuff. Was that something you always did, or did you just see, obviously with New Zealand there's a niche, how did that farming gear get started?
Yeah, it's really interesting actually, and it's a really interesting sort of anthropological sort of conversation. So back when we started 30 years ago, there wasn't super lightweight tramping gear. You know, the packs that, you know, the likes of MacPack and Furdown made were 12 ounce canvas, you know, rugged, heavy duty. We started making the same things, and because, you know, that was all you could make at the time. And then slowly other brands started getting super lightweight, and we decided that we didn't want to be just a generic brand doing generic products. We wanted stuff that was, you know, our brand promise is gear that wears in, not out. So we carried on making those things. And sort of if you look at the sort of historical tramper, you know, the dyed in the wool tramper that had a heavy canvas pack and big boots, and a farmer, the use case is pretty much the same. They're out all day every day in the wet and the cold, Matagari, mud. They need rugged, reliable gear. They haven't got time to sort of faff around with super lightweight stuff that takes a lot of maintenance. And so it was a natural progression for us. Actually, to be honest, it was more a natural progression for those customers as the other brands stopped kind of making the stuff that they actually needed.
I see that with down jackets that you buy, not non-cactus down jackets. If you just walk past the tree and it nicks it, it just tears a hole in it. The down jacket you make is basically bomb-proof. It's just everybody expects you to layer up, and you're buying all this gear where with you can just buy that down jacket and it's just gonna, might be a bit heavier, but it's just gonna keep and it's not gonna tear and it's gonna do everything that others have three jackets to do that thing's going to do in one.
It's funny. So we go to the field days in Hamilton and the Wanakarai and Peshow each year. And I was at the Wanakarai show a few weeks ago. And my thing is, you know, like a farmer comes in and I say, look, I'm not going to sell you this jacket. I can't have one. I'm not going to sell it to you. I just want you to try it on. And that's not this stupid sales ploy or whatever, but, you know, there's nothing better than seeing this 60-year-old farmer who comes in with his mate, looks at the price tag on the jacket and says, oh, that's an expensive jacket.
Well, yeah, yeah.
You're typical grumpy farmer. And then I say, look, no, don't buy one, but just try it on. And it's just incredible seeing someone try it on and their face lights up and they just understand. They go like, oh, yeah, I get it now. And whether they buy or don't buy it, I honestly don't care. But for me, you know, beyond the business stuff, the most important thing is people understand why we do what we do. And trying something on is the ultimate test of that. And you're right there. You know, our cameras down jacket. You know, we have situations where lots of the people that work down in Antarctica wear our gear and they all get supplied full uniform from other brands. They come to Christchurch, come into our store and buy our jacket and our pants with their own money. And so someone deciding to use our stuff despite getting other stuff for free, to me, that's kind of the ultimate test.
Do you still have to kind of advertise, or are you established enough? Does the outdoor crowd in New Zealand kind of know, and the farming crowd know enough of you, or do you have to actively kind of promote yourself?
So like I said before, right, our customers are our tribe. We think of them as part of our business, not as customers, but as part of the family. And so, you know, we do a lot of stuff communicating with our family. And so, you know, on social media, you know, my two boys, spend a lot of time recording, you know, dumb videos and yarning. You know, maybe some people would call that advertising. We just call it hanging out with our people. So we do that. We do go to things like the A&P show and stuff like that. But other than that, we really are a word of mouth brand, because it's very hard to, you know, if you don't know who we are, it's very hard to justify paying, you know, $1,000 for a down jacket. But if your buddy says, man, this is the best jacket you're ever going to wear, it's never going to wear out, and you're going to utterly rely upon it, then that's better than anything we can ever do.
It is a type of mindset, right, to buy the whatever $600 something that's going to last forever versus buying the $200 one that you're probably going to have to replace three times. And it takes that mindset change. And I'm in the latter. I'd rather pay more, and then you just freaking loss instead of. Is it that switch that happens when someone fits it on, or is it like how do you see that kind of mindset? Because we are in a society that just chucks away and just replaces.
Yeah, no, the switch is a little bit different. The switch is, you know, so if we have a poster in our stand at a show that says, you know, this is the toughest jacket. Everyone has that poster. Everyone's saying that. So the switch comes when someone puts it on and they go, oh, I actually get what the difference is between one of your jackets and one of the other jackets.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's similar to when, you know, I often joke with farmers about, you know, how many of them drive, you know, Hiluxes or Rangers versus Great Roads or SsangYongs or whatever. The vast majority of farmers can feel the difference between, you know, a good four-wheel drive and a crappy one, or even more importantly, a good tractor and a crappy one. And so it's kind of the same thing. And so that's the education piece. Like, you know, try it, don't buy it. Just try it on. And, you know, if you don't understand, that's fine. Go off to someone else. It's all good. But invariably, people try it on and they really get it.
When does a business, not just you specifically, like, I mean, I've got some gear from Sabre Tactical shooting stuff. I don't know if you know Sabre Tactical, also kind of local manufacturer. How does a business like you or like them or similar businesses go from starting to supply an industry and then becoming viable in a scenario locally where they have to pay someone a minimum wage, you know, they're not outsourcing it and just paying for shipping. Like, do you do it with bulk? Do you do it when you get a government contract? Like, how do you go from being kind of a almost a hobby to now we're viable and we're going? Like, do you, how does that happen? Is it just building scale? What is it?
Yeah, I mean, and bear in mind that, you know, for us, that was 30 years ago, and so times are very different. But we were always, you know, like back in the early days in Wellington, you know, we rented a bit of space and, you know, everyone kind of lived there and dosed down there. So we were never about this whole, you know, strategic plans and growth and whatever. We were just like, make a pack, sell a pack, make two packs, sell two packs. You know, it was just organic. It was just kind of living day by day. So for us, is that, I mean, there's the proof points where you realize actually you have kind of made it, whatever made it means. And in the early days for us, that was, you know, the first time we saw someone walking down Lambda Quay wearing one of our packs, and that wasn't one of our friends or family. So there's those proof points like that. But I think, like, we've never had any external funding. We've never had any debt. We've always just kind of grown organically. The business gurus today would tell you that you've got to go out and raise tens of millions of dollars and spend money on IP lawyers and brand marketers and whatever. That wasn't our jam. We would be, you know, if we had done that, we'd be bigger and more profitable and whatever, but we would have sold our souls in the process, I think.
You also belong to a, I don't know how to define this, so please correct me, but almost like a B Corp, not B Corp, but you're kind of affiliated to an association that, you know, I don't want to say tick boxes, but there's certain criteria you have to meet. Just tell me more about that, who they are and what that means in your company.
Yeah, so we're a certified social enterprise. What that means is that we're an organization that drives, you know, some would call it bottom line, some would call it a belt scorecard, but we're aiming for social and environmental as well as financial outcomes. So, you know, we have to certify to do all that, but we don't, you know, we haven't changed anything we've done because of that. We've always kind of been about, you know, people on the planet. And the gross thing is that every, you know, think about one of the, you know, horrible budget outdoor brands that I'm not going to name that's down the road from me where I'm sitting. And, you know, they all talk about being, you know, for people on the planet and, you know, all this sort of stuff, and it's just bullshit, you know. So that's who we are. Like I say, it's not a way to maximize profit, and, you know, quite the opposite. But I'm well aware that, you know, in 100 years' time, whether I made, you know, $10,000 salary this year or $10 million salary, or, you know, that will mean nothing 100 years' time. What will mean something is kind of the legacy you left. And for me, my legacy, you know, personally, is that, you know, I've got two amazing, men that work in the business. I want their children to work in the business and still be part of a vibrant ecosystem here in New Zealand. So for me, that's what, you know, the business is about, I guess.
Are there other brands locally or internationally that you're kind of a fan of? I bought myself a Falrof and pants a while back, and I'm now wearing it to work, and then I wear it on weekends, and I just wear it. And I mean, I don't know if there's some industry thing about them that I'm not aware of, but I'm really a fan because it fits me, you know, and I also kind of prepare. Are there brands that you kind of think, oh wow, these are brands to aspire to, or they're like, yeah, are there people like that out there?
Yeah, so I'd say that, so in different sort of areas. So Fjallraven I really like because I like the whole Scandinavian thing. I used to live in Denmark. I love their aesthetic. I really like Arc'teryx, the way it was kind of back in the early days when it was really cool technical product. But in terms of a brand from a value set, I mean, you know, how can you look past Patagonia? I mean, Yvonne is an incredible individual. He's actually genuine. You know, all that I said before about people who say this shit, but don't actually mean it.
Yeah.
He actually does, Patagonia actually does. I mean, I think that we would, in our most, ambitious moments, we would, we would suggest that we are, we are the Patagonia of New Zealand.
Mm.
I think that there's some things that we do because we're a lot younger that probably Patagonia would be doing today if they had started later. So I mean, absolutely no criticism of Patagonia. They're an amazing company and story.
Have you met Devon Chouinard or not?
I haven't. He was at, so they opened a Queenstown store recently, and he was actually there at the opening.
I didn't know that.
And spent some time fly fishing in New Zealand afterwards. I would absolutely love to, not from a fanboy kind of perspective, but I mean, I'd love to invite him here to the factory and to just have a yarn about legacy, really, because he's built one, we're trying to build one, and that would be a really interesting conversation, maybe one day.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of, well, him. I've read his fly fishing book and obviously a lot of documentaries, and I climbed in Yosemite with my brother, who lives in the States, and did a couple of trad routes there with my brother and some bouldering, and that's obviously Patagonia has some roots there. And I hope when Yvon Chouinard is not around anymore, the company keeps on going the way they do, but I think they will.
Well, he's ensured that with the changes that he instituted last year. So I hope nothing that will.
What challenges is the industry going to face in future? I mean, is it just completely dwindling? Is it on the way out? Like, what's your concerns in terms of local manufacture?
Yeah. Oh man, it's so hard. And to be brutally honest, we do manufacturing because it's the right thing to do, because it's good to support who we are as a business. But it is to the detriment of Cactus financially. I think that, if I was being super optimistic, I'd say, well, what might happen is that people might realize and things might change, like we all thought with COVID, people would realize that they need to have a more resilient supply chain, but that didn't happen. We will always have manufacturing because we're a little brand, and there's some things we do that you just, there's no point doing, you wouldn't be able to do them overseas because you haven't got the quantity. So we'll always have a facility here, we'll always do our own repairs, we'll always have that stuff going on. I don't think the local industry is going to get any better anytime soon.
I realize now, talking to you, I should actually be slightly embarrassed wearing my backpack top that I bought on a special. Next two pieces of gear that I want to buy from you guys is a toss up between two. It's a toss up between pants, because I feel, especially when you go on holiday and you're hiking and you're traveling, it's awesome just to put one pair of pants on and just wear it straight through. And then a rain jacket, because I feel I've been cycling rain jackets. There's a while, after a while you have to start washing them like a lot, and you have to like I don't know what the correct term is, but waterproof them. Yeah. And most of the rain jackets, because I rock climb for long, are shorter jackets, so you can work with the belaying. But really for New Zealand, you need that longer jacket that you guys are manufacturing. It needs to cover your butt, and it it needs to be harder wearing if you're maybe going through scrub or something. So for me, that's the toss up between the two. I don't know which one yet. What's next for you? Is it just kind of remaining stable? Is there new products that I should look out for? Like, what do you see happening in the next 5 years and 10 years with Cactus?
Well, 5 and 10 years is a long time, but get new products for sure. We've got a new lighter weight insulated jacket, which we introduced recently, which is a synthetic insulation, so a little bit more, less maintenance or less concern with water and stuff down. Look for some stuff in the rain jacket line of things, maybe a bit lighter weight. And in terms of more generally for business, it's difficult times in New Zealand right now for sure. So everyone's doing it tough. We are sort of, super focused on doubling down on kind of our core value proposition, our core kind of, about the people, about the community. We might be doing a new store in Christchurch. Don't know if I'm allowed to tell people that, but the boys have been hinting about it on Instagram. So we're doing that. So yeah, just more That's of the cool. same, and just keeping going.
And then for you or for the boys or for anyone, like, are there big missions coming up or outdoor missions that you're looking forward to?
Yeah, so I've got a bunch of similarly aged running mates. We run around sort of Hagley Park a couple of times a week, and we're going to go have a mission this year down to do the Kepler. One of our buddies has had knee problems for about 6 months. He's just had an operation, so that will be his comeback. So looking forward to that. Old Ghost every year, and just keeping on really.
Cool. That's my valley because I'm in Invercargill. Your beanie is going on a chamois hunt tomorrow. A bit of a day mission. The weather here is looking dire. Like, I'm at this stage, I don't come back when it's been a rough day saying this was a great day. I prefer the days when there's a lot of sun and the temperature is not too cold, which I probably shouldn't admit having a bit of an outdoor podcast. But Ben, thanks. I really appreciate it. Awesome products. The idea of buying something that lasts resonates with me, and I think it's pretty cool what you guys are doing, and I'm really a big fan, and I'll probably be at field days, and I'll come say hi and fit a bit of gear and walk out with a package or two.
It's just been a pity. Come and say good day.
Cool. Thanks, Ben. I appreciate your time. Good luck on that side. And I hope you have a good Easter weekend.
Awesome. Thanks, man. You take care.